will be the most likely outcome of the Israeli-U.S.-supported genocide assault on Gaza and elsewhere in Palestine?
Well, everything changed on March 2nd with the enforced starvation. And that, of course, means that there's very little time left. They have set up these woefully inadequate, quote-unquote, feeding stations in the south along the nine-mile border with Egypt to lure Palestinians who are hungry, of course, like mice into a trap. I think that there's a supposition among many of us, and much of that area is just a fence between that and the Egyptian Sinai, and you create this mass of desperate humanity, and they just essentially burst through fence. The fact that Israel is just refusing to allow any food or humanitarian aid in other than this kind of symbolic, you know, there's, what, two or three feeding stations. And, of course, there's been riots, not unexpectedly, with over 20 people shot and killed. I mean, the whole thing is very cynical, and no one's doing anything to stop it. I mean, the United States just vetoed a ceasefire resolution at the UN. So you've seen the rhetoric change out of Europe with Starmer and Macron and others. But, of course, they're still funneling the weapons to perpetuate the genocide. So I think our fear is that we're probably weeks away. If food is not let in, there is really very little time left.
Chris, you've written in one of your reports that, and I quote, "In fact, genocide is the currency of Western
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We were never eager for war. We made every effort to prevent war. Let me emphasize that, despite our mistrust, we negotiated and wanted the negotiations to yield results. We were also ready to present our program in the sixth round, but they did not leave room for this matter.
Fighting between Israel and Iran has entered its fourth day after Israel launched a sweeping, unprovoked attack to start a war between the two most powerful militaries in the Middle East. The attack began as a new round of negotiations between Iran and the United States were set to take place over Iran's nuclear program. We'll speak with Iranian-Israeli activists Orly Noy in Jerusalem and Ali Vaez of the International Crisis Group. Then, no kings.
I'm 16, and I'm out here because I want a future. I am carrying a sign that says no kings because I believe that in America, we are a democracy.
Millions of people marched in at least 2,000 protests across the United States as tanks rolled through the streets of Washington, D.C. for President Trump's 79th birthday. And then to Minneapolis, where a former Minnesota House Speaker was gunned down with her husband, another state senator and his wife shot multiple times. The alleged assassin, who was dressed as a police officer, has been caught in the largest manhunt in Minnesota history.
A moment in this country where we watch violence erupt. This cannot be the norm. It cannot be the way that we deal with our political differences.
The executioner's hit list included 70 names of Democratic lawmakers and abortion providers or pro-choice advocates. We'll speak with Patricia Torres-Ray, a former Minnesota state senator who worked closely with Minnesota former House Speaker Melissa Hortman, who was killed, and State Senator John Hoffman shot. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Fighting between Israel and Iran's entered a fourth day after Israel launched a sweeping, unprovoked attack to start a war between the two most powerful militaries in the Middle East. Since Friday, Israel's assassinated nine Iranian nuclear scientists, along with key figures in Iran's military and intelligence leadership, including the intelligence chief and deputy intelligence chief of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, who was killed Sunday. today. Earlier today, Israel struck the command center of Iran's Quds Force. Iran's health ministry reports a total of 224 people have been killed and 1,400 injured in Israeli attacks in Iran, with the majority of victims reported to be civilians. Iran responded by launching a wave of missile attacks on Tel Aviv, Haifa, and other Israeli cities, killing at least 24 people and injuring more than 500. One missile reportedly fell near the U.S. embassy. Israel attacked Iran Friday, just 2 days before the U.S. and Iran were scheduled to hold another round of nuclear talks. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi accused Israel of sabotaging the talks.
The Israeli government is neither seeking any type of agreement on the nuclear issue nor looking for negotiations or diplomacy. Attacking Iran in the midst of nuclear negotiations demonstrates Israel's disagreement with any form of negotiation. What has transpired now is precisely an attempt to sabotage diplomacy and negotiations, and we regret that the United States took part in it.
The Iranian foreign minister also accused the United States of supporting Israel's bombardment of Iran. One Israeli official told the Jerusalem Post, quote, there was full and complete coordination with the Americans. During an interview on Fox News, the Israeli prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, said Israel's war in Iran could lead to a regime change. He was questioned by Brett Baer.
So is regime change part of the effort here?
Could certainly be the result, because the Iran regime is very weak.
We'll have more on this story after headlines. After a two-day manhunt, authorities in Minnesota have detained a 57-year-old man accused of assassinating the Democratic state lawmaker Melissa Hortman and her husband in their home early Saturday. The suspect, Vance Belter, is also accused of shooting and wounding State Senator John Hoffman and his wife at their home. He was shot 9 times, she 8. Authorities say Belter carried out the shootings while disguised as a police officer. A hit list written by the gunman was later discovered. It contained the names of about 70 other potential targets, including other lawmakers and Planned Parenthood centers. Authorities also found flyers for Saturday's No Kings rallies, prompting many organizers in Minnesota to cancel the protests due to safety concerns, since at the time he was still on the loose. Belter has been described as a supporter of Donald Trump and a longtime opponent of abortion and LGBTQ rights. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz spoke Sunday night and denounced political violence.
A moment in this country where we watch violence erupt. This cannot be the norm. It cannot be the way that we deal with our political differences. Now's the time for us to recommit to the core values of this country.
Governor Walz has also paid tribute to Melissa Hortman, who'd served as Speaker of the House in Minnesota from 2019 till earlier this year. Her legislative victories included codifying the right to abortion in the state constitution and providing free school lunches to children. More than 5 million people took part in No Kings Day protests Saturday, and the largest day of action against President Trump since his return to office. Protests were held in over 2,100 cities and towns. In Los Angeles, 200,000 people marched just days after Trump deployed the National Guard and Marines. In Philadelphia, over 100,000 people took to the streets. Democratic Congressmember Jamie Raskin of Maryland addressed the crowd.
Yes, Donald, the Declaration and the Constitution were written by people who wanted to stop criminal bosses like you from taking state power.
Massive No Kings Day protests were also held in New York, San Diego, Chicago, Seattle, and other communities across the country. Devin Johnson took part in the protests in Atlanta.
I don't recognize our country anymore. I don't believe that parents should be taken away from their kids. No one is legal on stolen land. And when our president does not listen to our courts, then we're in a pretty bad spot.
We'll go to the No Kings protests later in the broadcast. In Salt Lake City, Utah, one person was killed after a gunman armed with an AR-15-style rifle ran into the crowd at a No Kings Day protest. A designated peacekeeper working at the march fired shots at the gunman, but one of those shots fatally struck a peaceful protester, Afa Alu, who was a prominent Samoan fashion designer who once appeared on the show Project Runway. The size of the No King's Day protest dwarfed the turnout of a military parade held in Washington, D.C. on Saturday, which was President Trump's 79th birthday and the 250th anniversary of the U.S. Army. The parade reportedly cost $45 million and up to $100 million. On the eve of the military parade, dozens of veterans were arrested, including seniors in their 80s, after a group of activists with Veterans for Peace and About Face took to the steps of the U.S. Capitol to demand an end to wars abroad and on U.S. city streets. In Gaza, at least 20 Palestinians seeking aid were killed earlier today near an aid distribution site in Rafah. Over 200 others were wounded. Officials in Gaza say Israeli attacks in recent weeks have killed more than 300 Palestinians seeking aid from the shadowy new U.S.-backed Israeli operation known as the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. An additional 2,000 Palestinians have been wounded near the aid sites. On Friday, a UN official said the new aid operation has been a, quote, failure from a humanitarian standpoint. This is Dr. Ahmed Afara, a doctor in Khan Yunis.
Example for the people, for the innocent people, they are going to the distribution aid and they were targeted by gunshot by snipers. As you see, it is a gunshot in the head. The brain matter is out. This is one of the most catastrophic and serious complication of the distribution aid.
This comes as activists taking part in the global march to Gaza have been violently blocked by Egyptian authorities as they've attempted to make their way to the Rafah border crossing with Gaza. Since the international effort to break the Israeli siege launched last week, members of the convoy have been beaten, arrested, had their passports confiscated, and have been deported. Reports on the ground say thugs paid by the government of Abdel Fattah el-Sisi have attacked the convoy. The international group of thousands include members of the parliament from Ireland, Turkey, and South Africa. A video emerged over the weekend of the Turkish MP Faruk Dinç with a bloodied head following an attack on the convoy. Security forces in Libya have also blocked the activists. Massive marches in solidarity with the convoy and with Gaza took place over the weekend, including in Belgium, France, Brazil, the Netherlands, where about 150,000 rallied at The Hague. Meanwhile, the last three Gaza Freedom Flotilla activists in Israeli custody have been deported to Jordan. A federal judge Friday refused to release Columbia graduate Mahmoud Khalil from an immigration jail in rural Louisiana. Earlier last week, U.S. District Judge Michael Farbiars in New Jersey ruled the government's continued imprisonment of Khalil over his Palestinian rights activism would be found unconstitutional, raising hope for his release. But Judge Farbiars did still accept the Justice Department's rationale for keeping Khalil locked up for alleged fraud on his 2024 green card application over what it claims were undeclared affiliations. Mahmoud Khalil's lawyer called the Trump administration's tactics targeting Khalil unjust, shocking, and disgraceful. President Trump's threatening to expand immigration raids in Los Angeles, Chicago, and New York and other cities, targeting what he called, quote, the core of the Democrat power center, unquote. In a post on Truth Social, Trump ordered ICE officers to, quote, do all in their power to achieve the very important goal of delivering the single largest mass deportation program in history, unquote. In Vermont, advocates are demanding the release of two immigrant justice leaders who were detained over the weekend. Jose Ignacio Nacho de la Cruz was driving his stepdaughter, Heidi Perez, when they were pulled over by Border Patrol agents who smashed their car window, violently arrested the two organizers. Both members of the farm workers-led group Migrant Justice now face deportation. De la Cruz has long been an advocate for workers' rights in the dairy and construction industries and has helped push for immigrant rights legislation in Vermont. Heidi Perez just graduated high school and has advocated for higher education for immigrant students in Vermont. The Trump administration is considering significantly expanding its travel ban to include nationals from another 36 countries. That's according to the Washington Post, which obtained a memo issued by the State Department. The countries that could face a full or partial ban include U.S. allies like Egypt, as well as another two dozen African nations, including the Democratic Republic of Congo, Burkina Faso, and South Sudan. And here in New York City, Early voting has begun to select a new mayor. The two frontrunners in the heated Democratic primary are progressive assembly member Sohan Mamdani and former governor Andrew Cuomo, who resigned in 2021 in disgrace in the wake of an official report detailing sexual harassment of at least 11 women while he was in office. Last week, Mamdani and Brad Lander, the city's controller, who's been polling in third place, co-endorsed each other in New York City's ranked choice voting as part of an effort to ensure Cuomo stays out of office. Sohan Mamdani blasted Cuomo's record as governor during a televised debate last week.
To Mr. Cuomo, I have never had to resign in disgrace. I have never cut Medicaid. I have never stolen hundreds of millions of dollars from the MTA. I have never hounded the 13 women who credibly accused me of sexual harassment. I have never sued for their gynecological records. And I have never done those things because I am not you, Mr. Cuomo. And furthermore, the name is Mamdani. M-A-M-D-A-N-I. You should learn how to say it because we got to get it right.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Fighting between Israel and Iran's entered a fourth day after Israel launched a sweeping, unprovoked attack. Since Friday, Israel's assassinated 9 Iranian nuclear scientists and much of Iran's military and intelligence leadership, including the intelligence chief and deputy intelligence chief of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, who was they were killed on Sunday. Earlier today, Israel struck the command center of Iran's Quds Force. Iran's health ministry reports a total of 224 people have been killed in the Israeli attacks. Iran has responded by launching a wave of missile attacks on Tel Aviv, Haifa, and other Israeli cities, killing at least 24 people and injuring more than 500. One missile reportedly fell near the U.S. embassy. Israel attacked Iran Friday, just 2 days before the U.S. and Iran were scheduled to hold another round of nuclear talks. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi accused Israel of sabotaging the talks.
The Israeli government is neither seeking any type of agreement on the nuclear issue nor looking for negotiations or diplomacy. Attacking Iran in the midst of nuclear negotiations demonstrates Israel's disagreement with any form of negotiation. What has transpired now is precisely an attempt to sabotage diplomacy and negotiations, and we regret that the United States took part in it.
This comes as President Trump and other world leaders arrive in Calgary, Canada, ahead of the G7 summit. The G7 includes the U.S., Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and the United Kingdom. The Israel-Iran conflict is expected to be topping the agenda. President Trump's posting about the conflict on his social media platform Truth Social, where he's denied any U.S. involvement in the attacks and said his administration remains committed to a diplomatic resolution on Iran's nuclear program, but then said something about the sides having to continue to fight. We're joined now by two guests. Orly Noy is an Iranian-Israeli political activist and editor of the Hebrew language news site Local Call. She's also chair of B'Tselem's executive board. Her new piece for 972 is headlined, Israel's Greatest Threat Isn't Iran or Hamas, but Its Own Hubris. She's joining us from Jerusalem. Ali Vaez is with us from Washington, D.C., the Iran Project Director at the International Crisis Group. His latest piece for Time magazine is headlined, The Grim Reality of the Conflict Between Iran and Israel. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! Ali, let's begin with you. The significance of the timing of Israel's attack on Iran that seems to be expanding on both sides, right before the U.S. was negotiating with Iran on a nuclear deal in Oman, those talks called off because of this attack. Ali.
It's good to be with you. Look, I think Benjamin Netanyahu basically bombed away President Trump's only possibility for a diplomatic win early on in his second term. The reality is that if you look at the three main files that Steve Witkoff, his special envoy for the Middle East, was working on, Gaza, Ukraine, and Iran, it was only in the case of Iran that the Iranian leadership shared the political will and the objective of getting a diplomatic settlement, whereas that doesn't apply necessarily to Putin in Russia or Netanyahu when it gets to the Gaza war. But by taking this preemptive strike against Iran, Netanyahu basically ensured that the door to diplomacy is closed for the foreseeable future.
And explain, I mean, the number of nuclear scientists, leadership in Iran who have been killed, the level of, it seems, such almost complete penetration of the Iranian leadership to be able to kill all of these leaders within Iran. Talk about the significance of that. And then the latest we heard of the media reporting, according to various sources, President Trump vetoed killing the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei.
Yeah, look, there is two things could be true at the same time. One is that Israel has deeply penetrated the Iranian system. There is no doubt that the Islamic Republic has serious intelligence loopholes that Israel had used over the years for covert operations, whether they were sabotage of nuclear facilities or assassination of nuclear scientists and IRGC commanders. What's impressive about this round of confrontation between the two countries is that everything is happening at the same time. We're seeing the military attacks by Israel on Iranian territory that happened in 2024, all of these covert operations, a high degree of electronic warfare, cyber warfare, psychological operations, all happening at the same time. But it is also true that the Iranian leadership and bureaucracy and the political elite has deep roots. This is not a non-state actor where when you kill the first two layers of the top brass of the military, for instance, that it will be paralyzed. This is a state, and there are always people in the ranks who are ready to step up and fill those positions. It is also true that Iran's nuclear program has deep roots. It started in the 1950s. So there is not just institutional, but also a high degree of scientific community and knowledge that exists in Iran that cannot be easily bombed away or by assassinating a dozen Iranian nuclear scientists. And most important of all, Amy, is the fact that the sites that matter the most to Israel, where Iran keeps its advanced centrifuges and a stockpile of highly enriched uranium, the site in Fordo, which is under a mountain and highly fortified, have been largely unaffected as a result of these strikes, because Israel does not have the kind of bunker buster weapons that are required to destroy Fordo.
And the significance of the reports that Trump said don't kill the supreme leader?
So, look, I'm always skeptical of these kind of leaks because it's not clear who leaked it and for what purpose. It might be that President Trump wants to signal to the supreme leader that he is not hostile and play the game of good cop, bad cop, with Israel being the bad cop here. It's also true that it might be an Israeli leak aimed at forcing the hand of President Trump to say that he's not opposed to Israel taking out Iran's supreme leader. He's not the protector of the Ayatollah. So who knows? But the reality is that at the end of the day, from the perspective of the Iranian leadership, it does not matter, because they believe that the United States is complicit in Israel's attacks against Iran and its senior leadership. And they believe the objective of Israeli strikes is not just to degrade Iran's nuclear program, but to destabilize its regime.
I think it's pretty clear also that the U.S. officials said they knew about this attack before it happened. I want to go to Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian speaking during a cabinet meeting in Tehran Sunday about the U.S. position on the attacks on Iran.
Israel knows no boundaries. They intrude whatever they want with permission from America. In a conversation that Witkoff had with Dr. Araki, he said that Israel cannot do anything without our permission, meaning this recent strikes is also carried out with America's permission.
And this is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu speaking Sunday.
We are now confronting the two greatest threats to our existence, the Iranian nuclear threat and the threat of Iranian ballistic missiles. We acted at the 12th hour, before Iran could move forward and produce nuclear weapons, and before it could accelerate the development of 10,000 ballistic missiles, the kind that have hit Bet Yam and other places. In 6 years, they could have 20,000. These are external threats, and we are acting to stop them.
I want to bring Orly Noy into this conversation, the editor of the Hebrew language Local Call, chair of the human rights group B'Tselem's executive board, who has that new piece out for 972 headlined Israel's Greatest Threat Isn't Iran or Hamas, but its own hubris. Welcome back to Democracy Now, Orly. Respond to what is happening right now, what Netanyahu just said, the bombing that's going on. Hundreds of Iranians have been killed, overwhelmingly civilian, and at least 24 Israelis have been killed in Iran's retaliation.
Thank you, Amy, for having me. First, I must say that I am an Israeli citizen, but I'm also of Iranian origin, and I grew up in Iran, and it's really, truly heartbreaking to see the footage that is coming from Iran as well as from inside Israel. I mean, we are in yet another extremely violent cycle, and no one can anticipate where it will get. You asked previously about the timing of this attack, and of course, the Iranian-American negotiations is a huge part of it, but I want to emphasize the local side of the timing of this particular attack. After more than 20 months of a war of annihilation in Gaza, which started with a promise of crushing Hamas and bringing back the hostages, neither which has been achieved, neither of the goals until this point. The Israeli Netanyahu started to lose He started losing support among the Israeli public for that war. People started finally to question what it is that we are doing there. Finally, after more than a year and a half, footage from Gaza started appearing in the Israeli press with people starving, with people being bombed just for seeking food. And again, no sign of the hostages. Soldiers keep getting killed. So he started to lose support around that. The army, which is almost has the status of a god in Israel, took a very serious strike to its prestige, not being able to defeat Hamas after such a long time. So both Netanyahu and the Israeli army needed an immediate rehabilitation to their prestige. Now, Netanyahu has been portraying Iran as the ultimate demon for so many years, and now this is the moment where he is enjoying the fruit of this long-last campaign. Because he gave the Israelis a war which they can be united around it. You can see that today, even Netanyahu's opponents, even the Israeli Jewish opposition, is so taken and so impressed by this brilliant achievement of the army and the unbelievable strike and the technology and whatnot. And all of a sudden, Netanyahu is regaining his prestige. The Israeli army is regaining his prestige. And as per usual, it's only a matter of time until we pay a big enough of a price in death, in devastation, before the Israeli army, the Israeli public will wake up and ask, why did we do that? And how does that war now serve our interests?
Is there questioning even now, as more and more Israelis are killed in the retaliatory attacks, about what Netanyahu, who faces his own corruption trial, as you were saying, and more people are seeing the devastation of Gaza. How popular would you say this move is? And is there an acknowledgement that the what seemed to be the deadline for Netanyahu was the U.S. and Iran agreeing on an Obama-like nuclear deal?
Well, unfortunately, and really I'm saying it with deep sorrow, as for now, he has the support of the majority of the Israeli public. People in Israel are very easy to believe the imaginary threats that Netanyahu uses. And again, Netanyahu used and built up this Iranian demon in the eyes and the minds of the Israeli public for so many years that when now he's telling them, I'm going to shape a new Middle East with no Hezbollah, with no Hamas, with no Palestinian Authority, and with no nuclear Iran, people are applauding. I mean, some of the most critical journalists that used to, you know, criticize Netanyahu on a daily basis, all of a sudden are praising his courage, his ability to see into the future.
Early, I want to bring Ali Vaez in before he has to leave. And Ali, I wanted to go to G7 because it looks like world leaders are trying to put pressure on Netanyahu to stop the attacks. It is unclear exactly where Trump stands, who's with them in Calgary, in Canada, since he has expressed both sides on this. Talk about this, what the U.S. needs to do right now, who clearly everyone acknowledges has the only lever of power that can be exerted over Netanyahu.
That's correct. President Trump is the only world leader who can stop the cycle of escalation from expanding into a much more disastrous regional conflagration with direct costs for the United States and him as president. Because if he gets engaged, if there are American fatalities and casualties, if the price of energy markets, global energy markets increase in the next few days, all of it would backfire on him politically, and especially with his MAGA base that is deeply opposed to any additional U.S. military entanglements in that part of the world, especially if it's aimed at regime change. Now, the way he needs to tackle this is to first, he needs to create distance with Israel, because there is no way that the Iranians would go back to the negotiating table and take him seriously if they are seen as him playing a double game here. And the only way he can do that is to use the leverage that you mentioned, which is the provision of offensive weapons to Israel. I think he can still stand next to Israel in defense of Israel, but he has to threaten that if Netanyahu continues this war, which endangers the 40,000 American troops in the Persian Gulf region and hundreds of thousands of Americans who live in Israel, that he would pull the plug on Netanyahu's ability to further escalate this conflict. And then he needs to turn to the Iranians and do two things. One is to also threaten the Iranians that if they keep fighting, the U.S. would get involved. That is exactly what ended the Iran-Iraq war in 1988. The U.S. intervened in that conflict, and that was a huge part of Iranian calculus to agree to a ceasefire. And he also has to simultaneously put an offer on the table, a nuclear deal that is reasonable, that is not one-sided, that includes generous sanctions relief, so that the Iranians, with all the mistrust, start seeing in him as somebody who's really more interested in deal-making rather than double-dealing here.
Thank you very much, Ali Vaez. Before we go, Early Noy, we have just about a minute. As you said, you have a very unique perspective as an Israeli, Iranian-born, Iranian-raised woman, journalist, peace activist in Israel. Your final thoughts as the attacks go back and forth on this fourth day?
I think in a very short sentence, both countries' people are hostages in the hands of very corrupted, very dangerous governments. Both societies need to get rid of their prospective governments, but a war is not the way. And if anybody fantasizes that through violence, any political change sustainable towards more democracy, more freedom will occur in any of the countries, he's sadly, sadly mistaken.
Early Noy, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Iranian Israeli activist, editor of Local Call, Hebrew language media, and chair of the human rights group B'Tselem's executive board, speaking to us from Jerusalem. And Ali Vaez, International Crisis Group, Iran project director, speaking us to us from Washington, D.C. Next up, voices from the streets as millions upon millions of people in the United States join No King's Day protests. Stay with us. By Maku Sound System in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. At least 5 million people join No King's Day protests Saturday in the largest day of action against President Trump since his return to office. Protests were held in more than 2,100 cities and towns across the country. In Los Angeles, 200,000 people marched just days after Trump deployed the National Guard and Marines to the city. Protesters in L.A. included former Marine Melvin Hill.
I'm out here because I was willing to die for the things we have in our Constitution. And right now, I think our constitutional rights are being violated, stepped on, trampled on, and disregarded by a president, commander-in-chief, which would be Donald Trump. I mean, everything looks unlawful to me at this point in America.
In Philadelphia, over 100,000 people took to the streets. Democratic Congressmember Jamie Raskin of Maryland addressed the crowd.
Yes, Donald, the Declaration and the Constitution were written by people who wanted to stop criminal bosses like you from taking state power.
Major No King's Day protests were also held here in New York and San Diego, Chicago, Seattle, and other communities large and small. In Lyons, Colorado, a town of just 2,100 in the foothills of the Rocky Mountain National Park, hundreds joined the protests. This is Larry Quinn, an Army veteran and longtime Lyons resident.
I'm Larry Quinn, and I'm in Lyons, Colorado, population 2,100. And I'm here because my dad drove trains across France to defeat the Nazis. And then I served honorably, also in the Army, and I'm disgusted about the fascist regime we have.
The size of the No King's Day protests dwarfed the turnout for a military parade Saturday in Washington, D.C., held on President Trump's 79th birthday and the 250th anniversary of the U.S. Army. The parade reportedly cost as much as $100 million. Democracy Now! Spoke to some of the protesters in the nation's capital.
My name is
Brett Hines. I live here in Washington, D.C., and I'm here because I think that this is a waste of resources when we have hungry children and when we have people going to sleep without a roof over their heads.
And what does your sign say?
Sign says they got money for wars, but they can't feed the poor. It's a good line from Tupac.
I'm Amy. My sign says, no kings. I think that's the side. Yeah. The other side says the emperor has no clothes from the children's fairy tale or fable. I'm here because the president said that any protest would be met with hard force. I wasn't planning on coming, but that's un-American, anti-constitutional, and so I had to come. I was called to come. I also think this is an enormous waste of taxpayer dollars. As someone who got doged and lost my livelihood and my life's work, to have him turn around and spend $50 million on this, I think that's outrageous.
What type of work were you doing?
Bringing clean water to poor people.
And what's happened to that program, as far as you know?
It's gone.
My name's Aubrey Lowe. I was a captain in the Army for 8 years. So I'm a veteran. I deployed to Afghanistan once. I'm from El Paso, Texas, originally. I was a little nervous coming out today because I heard that peaceful protests might be met with a big force, in somebody's words. And so I let my folks know where I was going. I let friends know, and I'm glad that I've been able to be here without being heavily harassed. So that gave me some hope.
Army Captain Aubrey Lowe among those protesting Trump's parade in Washington, speaking to Democracy Now!'s Dennis Moynihan. For much of Saturday, news networks showed split screens of Trump's poorly attended military parade alongside footage of the massive No Kings protests. Here in New York, organizers say as many as 200,000 people gathered at Bryant Park before moving down Fifth Avenue to Madison Square Park. Democracy Now! Was there.
This is what democracy looks like.
Hi, my name is Jay Sean Sadler, he, him, and I am a father, I'm a guidance counselor, I'm a community member and world citizen, and I'm here now because I want to make sure that we preserve our democracy. I want to make sure that all people in this country are safe, regardless of if they're an immigrant, regardless of if they're straight, or if they're gay, or whatever they are. Like, everyone deserves to be free and safe.
Can you say what your sweatshirt says?
Yes, it says woke, not the insult that you think it is.
And who are you? And hi. How old are you?
My name is Rue. I'm 15 years old, and I use any pronouns. I'm here because I've seen firsthand how much destruction Trump's impact has caused on especially queer and trans youth. I've been in and out of a lot of places like that, and I've seen like how hard people have taken it. It's really hard to be a child in a society where you feel like people don't want you to exist. So I'm out here for the people who can't be out here. I'm very lucky to have a supportive father, but I know not everyone does. So I'm out here to give a voice to the people who don't have one and to show that we're still here. We're still out here. We're still going to be fighting.
The fact that there are thousands and thousands of people out here today, what difference does that make to you?
It honestly makes me so happy. After the election, I was really worried because I felt like the adults had kind of failed me. Since I couldn't vote, I was really like, you guys had all of the power. You guys could have stopped this, but people didn't. And I was so worried. I didn't even leave my house for a couple of weeks. But now it's just great that there's so many people here and that I'm not alone, you know?
Can you describe your flag to our radio audience in addition to our TV audience and hold it up?
So this is the inclusive pride flag. It has the regular rainbow stripes as well as black and brown for people of color in the queer community. Also has the trans colors and the intersex flag to support those people as well.
It's Pride Month. What do you have to say to President Trump on his 79th birthday today?
We're not scared of you, and I hope you have an awful birthday.
I am Dr. William D. Carter III. I am the senior pastor at the Franklin St. John's United Methodist Church, which is in Newark, New Jersey. And I came because I do not believe people's rights should be taken away, no matter their immigration status, no matter their orientation. People should have rights. And there should not be a king. We elected a president, not a king. So that's why I'm here today for this cause.
What does the sign say that you're holding?
It says prejudice, cowardice, accomplice.
And describe the flag to me.
Yes. This is an American flag. Even as a Christian, I believe in the right of all people, no matter their religious perspective, or even if they don't have a religious perspective, they ought to have rights. And that is the United States of America. United. We are united as one.
Your thoughts on your mayor, the mayor of Newark, Roz Baraka, being arrested as he attempted to, what he said was, do his duty to enforce oversight of an ICE jail with three Congress members.
Yeah. I love Mayor Roz Baraka. I think that he is doing a exceptional job, and I think him being arrested demonstrates his passion for the cause and just making sure that all people have rights.
My name is George. I'm 15 years old, and I'm out here because I'm scared of the future.
Tell me about the flags you're carrying.
I mean, I'm carrying the American flag and the trans flag because I think those two represent me. And because I think it's important to carry the flags that that I feel proud of.
It's raining. You think it's worth it to be out here?
100%. I would be out here in a storm. I would be out here if it was pouring. I'm just happy it's raining on Trump's parade.
My name's Lucy. I'm 16. And I'm out here because I want a future. I am carrying a sign that says no kings because I believe that in America, we are a democracy. We do not have kings. This is not right, and it needs to stop.
My name's Lily Bongiorno. I'm carrying an American flag. I'm here because I am in complete disgust by the injustice of Trump, especially towards immigrants and towards people's like rights. And I think that we should protest that every single day that he is still in office.
How old are you?
I'm 15.
How old are you? What's your name? And tell me about your sign.
I'm also 15. My name's Astrid Lemons. And my sign says, defend the Constitution, not the crown, because I believe what we should be doing is fighting for democracy and fighting for the future of us, the students, the young people who are going to live in our future, and we want this future to be a place where everybody can say what they want and nobody's attacked for that.
My name is Georgia Revely. I am 15 years old. I'm here to protest the Trump administration's treatment of not only immigrants but also women and students and basically almost everyone in the country. And I think it's really important that we have so many people here and all over the country and all over the world to show the Trump administration that we're not going to let this slide and that we as people can protest and that we can do it in a way where we can get our point heard. And I think it's important that young people are out here too. We're with We the Students New York, which gathers a bunch of students from all over New York City and does protests. We've done one before, a walkout in Washington Square Park.
And so, can you describe your double necklace to me?
I'm Jewish, so... it's a Jewish star, so I think it's important to, you know, people of all religions and all ethnicities should all be out here protesting the treatment of immigrants here, protesting the treatment of Palestinians in Gaza. I just think it's really important that we all be out here getting our word across.
My name is Caroline Gilman. I'm 15 years old, and I'm holding a sign that says, abort the presidency in the second term, and I'm here to fight for my future and all my friends' futures and the future generations of all the kids that are younger than us and every generation that came before us and fought for what we're fighting for now.
One struggle, one fight. Immigrant rights are workers' rights.
My name is Kimberly. I'm 27. I'm here because it's important to show up for these kind of things, show up for community. Community is so important, and anything I can do, like you guys, we should all just do, you know.
And tell me about your flag.
Oh, this is my Ecuadorian flag. My parents are both Ecuadorian. I'm very proud to be Ecuadorian. And, you know, so I'm here for the Latino community, for everybody who's, like, going through some right now because it's... The country is in a crazy start right now.
My name is Glenn Consav, and I'm the founder of Spirit. We are
in working in support of the End Super PACs campaign. As we know, the billionaires fund the elections, right? Like, what this image is implicitly saying is that if you have $200 million, you could just buy it. You and I, maximum contributions we can give is $5,400. It's insane that corporations can give whatever they want. And so there was a ballot initiative in Maine last November that made super PACs illegal. 73% of Mainers voted for it. And so their goal is to get it to the Supreme Court. What we do is we use augmented reality art and education to help people envision a world without the billionaires at the center, right? So, like, we're in New York. Everyone knows that public housing or housing in general is way too expensive. So what we're doing is, number one, we're showing a dystopic image as far as where things are going. We have a protopic image of, like, let's say Rebney and the real estate lobbies out the way. This could be the future of public housing right here. Community gardens, vertical farms, solar panels up top.
And what about this picture in the middle?
So this is Elon. I honestly don't think they're beefing because they didn't come. I don't think that Elon and Trump broke up because they still have the SpaceX contracts, like, show me the money. But basically, yeah, the man has $200 million, made $200 billion over the election, highest ROI ever. And he's pretty much running the show.
With a crown on his head.
Yeah, pretty much. So our goal is to do public teach-ins and demonstrations with this art, help people imagine a world without the billionaires, have people sign our petition. And then once we get the process templatized, we want to give other people materials to go to their neighborhoods and do the same.
Some of the protesters here in New York City, were an estimated 200,000 people marched as part of the more than 2,100 nationwide No King's Day protests that took place over the weekend. Estimates of upwards of 5 million people protested across the country, the single largest day of protest of President Trump's second term. Special thanks to Laura Bustillos. Coming up, we go to Minneapolis, where a former Minnesota House Speaker was gunned down with her husband, another state senator, and his wife shot multiple times. Stay with us. On the Mountains, rendition of Natalie Coleman and Nora Brown here in our Democracy Now! Studio. They recently performed at the Kennedy Center an unfurled banner protesting President Trump's takeover of the Cultural Arts Center. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. After the biggest manhunt in Minnesota history, authorities have detained a 57-year-old man accused of assassinating former Minnesota Democratic House Speaker Melissa Hortman and her husband in their home early Saturday. The suspect, Vance Belter, is also accused of shooting and wounding State Senator John Hoffman and his wife Yvette at their home. Authorities say Belter carried out the shootings while disguised as a police officer. Security footage shows Belter wearing a mask and a police vest and a badge as he approached Hoffman's front door in Champlin with a flashlight and a gun. Authorities say they were alerted to the attacks by a 911 call made after the initial attack on Hoffman and his wife by their daughter, Hope, who is at home with her parents. Hoffman was shot 9 times, his wife, Yvette, 8 times. She reportedly threw herself on in front of her daughter, Hope, to shield her. Hope was not shot. After police learned the shooting victim was a state legislator, they said they sent officers to the nearby home of Senator Hortman in Brooklyn Park. And when they arrived around 3:35 a.m., they found the suspect's SUV in the driveway. The Minnesota Star Tribune reports, quote, an officer watched as Belter shot Mark Hortman through the front door. And after an exchange of gunfire, Belter retreated inside the house and escaped. Police say they then found Melissa and Mark Hortman shot dead inside their home. In Belter's car, police found 3 AK-47 assault rifles, a 9mm handgun, a hit list written by the gunman that contained the names of about 70 people, including prominent Democratic lawmakers and abortion providers and advocates, naming Planned Parenthood. Flyers for Saturday's No Kings rallies were also found. This prompted many organizers in Minnesota to cancel their protests. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz spoke Sunday night, denounced political violence.
a moment in this country where we watch violence erupt. This cannot be the norm. It cannot be the way that we deal with our political differences. Now's the time for us to recommit to the core values of this country.
Governor Walz has also paid tribute to Melissa Hortman, who served as House Speaker in Minnesota from 2019 till earlier this year. Her legislative victories, including codifying the right to abortion in Minnesota's constitution and providing free school lunches to children. The alleged gunman, Vance Belter, is reportedly a conservative evangelical Christian who's posted on social media that he's strongly against abortion and LGBTQ rights. For more, we're joined in Minneapolis by Patricia Torres-Ray, who is a former Minnesota state senator who worked closely with Minnesota House Speaker Melissa Hortman and State Senator John Hoffman. Our deepest condolences to you and your community. Can you talk about who the House Speaker was and what this means in your state and for this country?
Melissa Hortman was an outstanding leader that was very loved and respected by many people. And what this means for us is that we lost a leader that was very important to us, not only to our communities as a human being and as a leader who did impactful work, but also obviously as a mother, as a friend. And we are not only shocked, but incredibly saddened. Melissa Hortman has been defined as the most consequential leader of the House in Minnesota history. And I agree with that statement. I think she has been the most consequential leader in our community. So we are profoundly sad and shocked, really, with the circumstances. It is so hard to ask.
Your whole community has been terrorized for 2 days because the alleged assassin wasn't caught for 43 hours. Can you tell us more about who the former House Speaker, Melissa Hortman, about her legacy? We just said that she had pushed to codify abortion in the Minnesota Constitution, fought for free school lunches for children in need. Can you tell us more?
Yes, I have a long list of her accomplishments as a leader, and I could go on, you know, to name a few of them, but I also want to talk a little bit about her leadership style, because I believe that that is really the most important thing that we need to review, especially in these times when it is difficult to galvanize a group of leaders that is as diverse as the House DFL caucus is. Melissa Hortman led a caucus of members that is the most diverse that we've ever had in the state of Minnesota. 32 people of color and indigenous people serve in that caucus, and we have very active, outstanding transgender members. So what Melissa Hortman was able to do in Minnesota is really galvanize her caucus and really appoint these leaders to serve in a collaborative, collective manner. And what we saw and what I saw as a Latina woman was, for the first time in the state of Minnesota, people of color in positions of power working with a leader to solve significant problems. And it was that coalition that really allowed her to move significant policy that we have not been able to do in a progressive state as the state of Minnesota, where we have the largest disparities in the country. So they were able to move, you know, child tax credits. She was very proud to move family and medical paid leave in Minnesota. We have the strongest protections for transgender people in the state of Minnesota. We legalize recreational marijuana. We passed driver's licenses for all people, regardless of their legal status. We did the largest increase for public education. We have free college for people who make under $80,000 in Minnesota. And I can go on. The list is just incredibly long.
Let me bring people, Minnesota former state House Speaker Melissa Hortman, in her own words, interviewed by CBS News Minnesota reporter Esme Murphy. In this clip, Hortman's discussing that new paid family leave program and paid sick leave mandate recently passed by the legislature.
Well, a lot of white-collar workers have this benefit, or highly compensated people already have this benefit. Most workers in the state don't have the ability to take paid time off when somebody in their family has cancer and needs to be taken care of. A lot of Minnesotans, when a member of their family is sick right now, they have to choose between staying at home and taking care of their loved one and not being able to pay their mortgage, or going to work and having their loved one not get the care that they need. But January 1st next year, that all changes.
That's the former House Speaker Melissa Hortman earlier this year. So painful to see her hear her voice. And it was Hope, the daughter of the Hoffmans, who were shot multiple times, her mother that protected her, who saved so many by calling 911. You know Hope. Can you talk about her significance in what she did in these last 20 seconds?
I am not surprised at all that Hope will have the courage in that moment to make that call and do what she had to do. She is the only daughter of a loving couple that just adore her. And she has been working in multiple issues on behalf of people with disabilities, just like her father.
I'm going to have I thank you so much for your participation in today's show. Patricia Torres-Ray, former Minnesota senator, worked closely with Minnesota former House Speaker Melissa Hortman and State Senator John Hoffman. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
CT scan that can detect lung cancer early. It takes only 60 seconds and could save